Nikki Meadows, thank you so much for joining me for this time today. First of all, how are you doing? It's that whole, how are you doing in the age of corona? But, you know, how are you doing? How are you holding up? 10 weeks in now, I think we are.
Yeah, 10 weeks. I'm doing all right. Yeah, like we were saying, I'm kind of learning new technology, meeting with vaxxers, which has been really lovely and absolutely keeping me sane and connected, so I don't just kind of sit and eat biscuits and cakes all day. So yeah, I'm doing all right. You know, I'm missing the outside world. Everyone is, but yeah, I'm trying to just keep myself busy.
Find the positives, and I think it is that thing where we knew this technology was sort of here, but we were so busy in our sort of other lives with, you know, other things keeping us occupied that you don't really know what it could really let you achieve. And I think if you find a silver lining, then, you know, the thing that, you know, we can now communicate through Zoom or Skype and have these kinds of chats and connect people is important now. But also, I think maybe coming out of it, there'll be a lot that we can sort of see. And you've been active. You've been really active. I've seen the Wii auditions popping up like all the time. And you've really been very sort of, you know, courteous and kind with your time and generous with putting that out there. How's that been?
Yeah, really nice, and you know, it's lovely because actors keep saying thank you, and you know, that's so lovely when they do. But you know, it's not totally selfless. You know, it's been really lovely for us as well. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I mean, I've been doing them on the audition, I've been doing them on Spotlight. So far, kind of keeping them sort of quite open and just not really knowing who's going to come in, which is really lovely. But I might start trying to do some more specific ones. And just, yeah, it's just been a lovely way of just, yeah, keeping in touch. And also, you know, talking about things that, you know, I'm always quite keen to talk about. Everyone's been asking about self-tapes, and that's quite interesting to me anyway, because I, you know, I work a lot with self-taping anyway. So just, I feel like I've been doing daily self-tape lessons to say, this is what you need to be doing. So yeah, lots of that.
And is that technical self-tape stuff, like, you know, your mic, your camera, your backdrop, or is it a bit of that and more just like how to get ready for a tape? Because I had someone on the show the other week from New York talking about self-tapes, and she said it's a different discipline to auditioning in the room. And the key distinguisher is that we don't have you guys there to guide us. We're alone.
Yeah.
And so what do you find is a common thread of questions?
Yeah, I think I've been more just trying to get people to start liking doing them, because a lot of people do say, you know, oh, I don't like it. It's not the same as being in the room with you. And of course it isn't. And we much prefer to have you in the room. But all my casting processes tend to start with self-tapes anyway. So for me, self-tape has always been really important. But I just think through this time, obviously, we're going to be hugely reliant on it. So I've just been trying to get people to fall in love with it a bit more and not fear it, and just, yeah, the technical sides of things, obviously we've talked a lot about that, and you know, tips about that, and I try to be quite straightforward on that stuff and not kind of demand that everybody should buy the latest kit and, you know, have all that stuff, because it's just not especially not now, not in this current situation where no one's earning any money. I think that's, you know, it's not necessary. So yeah, just talking through stuff like that, just answering questions about light and, you know, backgrounds and all the, you know, sort of fairly obvious stuff, but also just the way people prep for self-tapes and the importance to put on it, you know, to make it like an extension of how important you take the coming into the room. You know, when I send those scripts for self-tapes, I want people to take their time and enjoy it, you know, prep, don't feel like it's a race to get it in, because there'll be so much that I'll invest in, you know, I'll know how much they've invested. And equally, I'll be looking at those self-tapes and knowing that they haven't had any direction, but just watching how they've engaged with the notes that I've given them and how they've kind of worked on the characters, that's always really important. So just to enjoy it, really, I think, to try and see it as the first lovely bit of showing us how great you are.
It's an interesting point about the rushing it, because a lot of times you do get the deadline, like the agent will send it, and your agent will go, I need this by tomorrow at 3. Yeah. And the first thing that goes into your mind is that the casting deadline or my agent's deadline?
Yes.
But then either way, then you're like, it doesn't matter. It's a deadline. So then you've got, it's like the 24 clock is clicking off, and Kiefer Sutherland's kind of not around to bail you out. So you're on your own, and you're trying to figure out, well, what do I do? And it is that thing of, you don't want to be worried about the tech, but you have to kind of get that right. And it's giving yourself enough time to edit it and then upload it as well, which I think is why a lot of people think I've got to get it early. I've got to just blast this out. Would you argue that it's the counter, actually, that you should actually be spending more time at the beginning prepping because you don't have the direction from you?
Yeah, I'd also say, obviously each project's different. So, you know, I probably should, have a little disclaimer before I answer any question on any of this and say, this is just how I do it. But generally, I have the luxury of having, usually being able to give actors quite a bit of time. So I'm talking 3 or 4 days to turn on a self-tape. So in that time, hopefully you'd be, definitely you'd be off book unless something had happened. So yeah, I think absolutely investing in the content and thinking about that and it not being a race to get it in first. I'm always quite surprised when actors, I mean, fine, if that's just how it's fallen for you and you've just picked it up straight away and you've got it back that and it's great, then that's brilliant. But you know, you don't need to be first. It's not, I'm not marking people's times. I'm just really excited to see what they've done. So, you know, take as much time as you need would always be my advice. You know, obviously working on whatever, if your agent's giving you a different deadline to me, then obviously you need to go with that. But generally there'd be, you know, enough time to do that. And the tech stuff, you know, I think it's down to the actor. I mean, if having that tech stuff as part of your toolkit and you can afford to buy it just makes you feel more confident so that you can relax into the process of working on your performance and you're not worrying about all those other things, then great, of course. I just would try not to be prescriptive about how important that is because I wouldn't want actors that couldn't do that to then spend their whole time stressing that they needed to buy all this stuff. So I think it's, you know.
And there's going to be a time eventually, I hope, when we can travel again. And, you know, you never know, like, if you're not in your home little studio, you don't have all your stuff, and you've just got your phone, you still have to be able to do stuff in a bit of a DIY fashion, right? So that's important.
And I'm never looking, you know, I talk about this a lot with all sorts of things, whether it's showreels or this, you know, I'm not looking for, as long as I can see you and, you know, the lighting is careful and there aren't, I mean, God knows what mine's like. I'm trying not to look at myself and just look at you. but, you know, try not to have something that, you know, creates crazy shadows so that you can't see your expressions. You know, obviously make sure your framing is lovely so that we can see your eyes and all that stuff. But yeah, like you say, there's going to be times you're going to have to do it in all sorts of different ways. So I think it's more about that. It's more about just getting used to how you look on camera.
Do you feel like the best thing is that we just practice? I mean, you know.
Yeah, just. 100%. That's what I've been saying sort of most days. I think just get used to doing them, how it feels, looking back at them, looking at yourself in them, watching. I mean, I've been talking to quite a few actors that have do a lot of stage and are really, you know, kind of not sure how they transfer from stage to screen, which is, you know, a lovely thing for me anyway, because I'm often informed by things that I've seen on stage for actors. So I don't have any barriers to bringing stage actors in for screen stuff, not at all, and especially as we have such an amazing, we do such an amazing theatre scene in the UK and in London and regionally. So, you know, I'll often be seeing people who've done amazing things and in theatres like the Bush and places that I love and I'm missing very much. And you know, then I'll bring them in, and so for me, I think. For those kind of actors who are worried about that and don't believe that process happens, it does. It absolutely does happen, and I'm often really excited to do that. But those actors, maybe even more so, just keep practicing those screen, you know, those self tapes. Just watching what your face does, because you know it does a different thing for screen than obviously you're used to doing if you're used to performing on stage.
You know, it's also not getting in your head about it too much, though, as well. I remember.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, everything's kind of subjective. So you might do one tape and show one person that tape and they'll hate it. And someone else will watch it and go, that's pretty good. And you can get in your head. I remember some bad advice years ago of things like, you know, don't furrow your brow. Don't blink. Don't do this. And you're like, I'm not a like Audemon. Like I have to, if I blink once, I'm going to blink. Now I'm going to blink more because you've told me not to blink.
Exactly.
And then you're
not looking at myself.
But then you watch all these films and shows and you're like, well, hold on. Like, Leonardo DiCaprio just blinked about 3 times, so...
Yeah, that's what your face does.
That's what you're human. Exactly. So
I think just get used to what you do, and then you work around that performance and you bring that into your character. And unless there's an absolute reason why your character can't do what everyone else's face does, which is move around and react, then it's going to be fine. You know, it's just more about seeing it and understanding it, I think, if it's not a medium that you're used to as an actor.
And also, I think that the big one was this idea of, again, because you're not there to give us notes on that first run through. We just have what you send in, the breakdown, anything in the email, notes wise, and then the script. Obviously, yeah. We have to be big detectives in a script anyway for any audition. But would you argue that even more so with a self-tape? Because there's choice, like when we have to make a choice, which is a weird word that sometimes trips us up anyway, everything's on the page. But I think with a self-tape, we might feel that we don't know if we've done it right, so we'll keep going. You know, like you do 25 takes, then you do 30, and you at what point do you stop? And there's no one in the room to just say, "Cool, you're good, we can move on." How do you advise reconciling that? Is that prep work? Is that something?
Yeah,
you
do? I think it probably is prep work, and I think it's also trusting in your instincts and what feels most comfortable for you. I think we can't avoid that. I mean, what we do, I know what I do. Anyway, even before this, is that I'll try to give a slant on the kind of way. I mean, obviously, I work a lot in drama documentary, which makes that easier in a way because there'll be a story that we're trying to tell. But often that can also give a kind of bit of a bum steer because things like when we did Suffragettes, we were sending certain testimonies from, and obviously these were real testimonies, really powerful words that the women had said, but we weren't sending the obvious speeches that people knew. So for Emmeline, we didn't send big rousing speeches. I sent a speech that was much more rooted in her being quite anxious about holding that that role and being in that position and having to rally the women and not necessarily always having the confidence to know that she could reach different classes of women, because obviously, back in the day, that didn't happen. There wasn't the crossover socially that we hope, we pray there is now. And sometimes isn't still, but
better than before, but still.
Yeah, it's not good enough. But yeah, so it's difficult because we'll try to give all those steers. And for Drama Doc, I really try to do that because for the self-text for that, an actor, a brilliant actress, chose a different speech for Emily and sent it. And she said, I sent this one because I love this one. This is my favourite. And I sort of messaged back and went, no, but I didn't give you that one because I know you can give us that side of her. Most people can. I want to see this side. So I think we would always try to give you as many kind of notes. I know that's quite specific to what I'm doing, sorry, not maybe a great general answer. But I think I would always try to give as much as I could in my notes when I'm sending the script about the character, and then let you create, if it's fiction, let you create the kind of backstory that you need. And you can be bold, of course you can. I mean, but just obviously be sensible. As long as it fits. Bold for the sake of bold can be a bit.
I have this thing about the whole phrase make a choice or make a bold choice, because I think we can get tripped up by that. And I've brought this up with a few casting people. I'd love to get your view on it. What does make a choice or a bold choice mean?
I mean, I think it's different takes on something, isn't it? And I think I don't mind when someone, I think it's a back, for me that usually means someone, the backstory that someone's created and they go down a particular road with it. And if it's thoughtful and I feel that it's come from a place where they've really read the notes and they've really understood the character, even if it's a little bit off, I still respect that and understand it. And I might say to them, if that's on that for me, that would generally be in a self-tape situation first anyway, I'd go, I really love what you've done with that, actually. It's a kind of slightly different take that I know the directors, so I would give them that note and then we would get it. But that wouldn't stop someone coming in if they'd done it really well. So I don't necessarily, I'm not scared of those moves. I just wouldn't want them to be for the sake of it.
That's
Don't overthink it and try and be too clever, because I think ultimately I just want to see a fantastic performance. And if I've given you enough within that, the script that I've given you and the kind of arc of that piece that we've, or a couple of scenes that we've given you and the notes around it, you should be able to show me how brilliant you can be without having to, put some bells and whistles all over it. So I think it's an instinctive thing generally. I don't think there is a right or wrong answer.
I just think it's an interesting one to talk about because we hear it so often that I think, you know, even only the last past few weeks have I, for myself, started to demystify what that means conceptually. And it's what you're saying. I don't want to get the sides and go, well, this is this beat and that's that beat and that's that beat. And I'm going to decide logically to make a choice that plays against that, for example, because that feels very cerebral and forced, as opposed to, I think, what you're saying, which is don't make a choice, just let yourself naturally be the choice.
If there's a natural sort of story or backstory that's coming in from it, I think go with that. And, you know, in The Room as well, that's really interesting. So there's a young actor who I really love, who I cast in something middle of last year, and there's a really emotional scene between a young soldier and his sort of superior, where it wasn't melodramatic at all. It was just really beautiful, where he sort of asks him to go and says, "I promise, like I won't get killed, but I'm fitter and I can do this bit that they had to do." And the guy's arguing against him, and this young actor the director was playing against in the scene, and this young actor just shook him, which no one else had done. But it was so, people might have thought, so bold, but it was so lovely and so truthful, and it sort of really shook the director. But we loved it because that's exactly what that guy would have done in that situation. Like, you haven't really got time to debate this for 20 minutes while you're trying to be, you know, just go and let me do what I need to do. So,
but that feels like it was quite spontaneous.
Very spontaneous, and you know, a decision that was rooted in being in the character and knowing what to do
in that moment. It's not like he came in and said, "Nikki, when I get to 2/3 through the script."
But he might have planned to do that. You know, maybe. He might have well said at that stage, "I'm gonna, you know, be really physical about it." You know, that's what I mean. I mean, there are moments where you can bring things in that you might have planned and make it look spontaneous. I don't know, he's quite clever.
I'm just going to say that's a disclaimer to anybody watching or listening, not to assault a director. Just
No, sorry. See, I told you
I'm kidding. I'm just making a joke because my mind goes to really weird places, and I'm thinking, I wonder how that's
next. Every chance, I'll also swear, so we just have to be really careful with this.
Oh, I, the swearing thing is fine.
Good, okay.
So,
try not to swear. Don't encourage people to shake directors. Okay.
Exactly. Good. Take your vitamins and say your prayers, and we're all good. We've gone. Like, I mean, it's great because I love it. We've just kind of naturally, organically chatted about all these things, and I'm sure there'll be more to come. But I think maybe let's backstep it just a few moments. Obviously, we did kind of allude to your background of, you know, working in TV documentary drama. You mentioned obviously suffragettes, and that is your background area of sort of speciality, for lack of a term. So maybe we can just speak a little bit about how you got into casting, what inspired you to get into that, and then specifically that sort of area and how you've honed your I guess career into that part of it.
So I probably had a less sort of traditional route into casting than a lot of casting directors. So I didn't go to university. I left school and I went straight out to work. I'll try and make this really quick because I'm quite old, so it's quite a long story. So I went straight into work, got looking for a job, ads in a newspaper, which is what we did then, you know, circling them and stuff. And I saw, I think at the time I probably wanted to be, I went to work in a record shop or do something to do with music anyway. And I saw an office junior for a theatrical agency job. And it looked nice, so I went for it. And you had to type. And my then boyfriend's mum tried to teach me to type in about 6 hours before I was going in, which was, I'm in a complete shambles, bless her. I was a total lost cause. And I went in, but I somehow got the job. And years later, they said they thought that I'd probably never seen a typewriter before in my life because I was so rubbish. But that they thought I'd get on really well with the clients. And so it was a theatrical agency, an amazing, amazing agent called Joy Jameson, who I absolutely adored, who became like a bit of a mum to me. And I sort of spent 3 years there and decided that I wanted to be a theatrical agent. they sort of looked up to. It was a very small agency, but really high profile. So she was a member of the Personal Managers Association. So kind of taught me all those things about what matters in terms of, you know, doing things properly. You know, she had fierce loyalty to her clients and deals and you know, fair union rates and things like that, which were all the things that have kind of stayed with me, definitely. And she, I stayed with her for 3 years, and it was like a who's who of telly at the time in the late 80s. And then from there, I went to another theatrical agency when I kind of outgrew that, but sort of didn't want to leave because I loved it so much, but needed to really. And worked in comedy, worked for an agency called Noel Gay, who looked after loads of comedians, which I loved. And I was there for a year. And then one of their clients was also a music journalist and a music presenter, and we used to always talk about music, and he sort of said, you need to be working in music, really, much as you like this stuff. And I did. I really did love working with actors and comedians, and I did voiceovers and stuff there. He introduced me to someone at Elton John's office, and they created a job for me, which was amazing. Wow. So I sort of didn't know anybody. I mean, it's sort of weird because I was completely unconnected, but everywhere I went, there just seemed to be, I don't know, just things fell into place, which was really lovely for me. So they sort of created a job for me, and I was Elton John's press assistant when I started, and I stayed there basically for 8 years. And during that time, became his press officer, and which was lively, and as you can imagine, and obviously all the best stories I can't tell, because, you know, I'm probably still signed for the rest of my days. But, you know, amazing place to work in the 90s, you know, not just with him, but with the other clients that they looked after, like Ross and Billy Connolly and all these incredible, Barry Humphreys, you know, a really eclectic mix of people. And from there, Courtney Pine, who was a jazz saxophonist, a young jazz saxophonist, had signed to a record label, didn't have a manager. He came into the office and we clicked. And I started to manage him as his kind of day-to-day manager alongside doing all the press, and did that for, well, I'm still doing that. So I think Courtney and I have, got old and fat, and watched each other have babies and families together. And so I've been working with him for nearly 30 years, which is mad, really, to think of it.
It's crazy. You grow together with certain people in this industry. I mean, a lot of it is that very quick stint of, it's kind of like a circus, you know, you go, you connect for 2-3 months, and then you kind of disappear and cross paths again years later, and there's still that connection back to that time. But then there's others where, you, I guess, grow up together, right? And you literally see all those things you're saying, and it's like another family.
I would definitely see that relationship like that. And I think it's been really lovely, actually, to work. Because obviously my background was pop, you know, it was very pop. It was extremely high level, you know, huge teams around artists like Elton and Courtney was kind of a strange sort of, he fitted perfectly in that office, but it was a strange thing because he didn't have that kind of team. So from that, and when I left there and went off on my own and took him with me, it was quite lovely, actually, because you'd get to do all those jobs as opposed to having a different department in each record label to do them. And so you get a real sense of an artist's career progression and what matters and the decisions that you should and shouldn't make that aren't always monetary, because they're artistic decisions, and you know how someone's, you know, what someone's vision is for where they want to go with their career. So all of those things are really fascinating when you actually look after an artist that isn't, you know, that doesn't have that kind of mainstream pop machinery around it. So
even though I'm gonna guess, you know, even with the mainstream sort of pop machinery side of it, there are still, I'm gonna say, artistic and creative choices that you make. And sure there's gonna be numbers and money that might be on the other side of the coin, and it's maybe a slightly more head scratching choice, but it still is that balance of the two, I would imagine.
No, definitely. I meant more the fact that actually with the bit, you've got lots and lots of different people doing that. Whereas when you have an artist that works in a genre who's very successful within their genre but just not on that huge, that you end up doing lots of those jobs yourself, which is kind of quite interesting.
It's interesting to hear about, obviously it's from the musical side, but you mentioned working with comedians and actors as well, and to hear your you talking about in terms of growing together and having that loyalty and sort of that nurturing element, which I think for a lot of actors, you know, I allude to sort of the agent relationship as being a little bit like dating at the beginning. You kind of go through a few till you find the right one. I don't think there is a right vibe or dynamic. It's down to the individuals to click. But would you say there's certain, from your experience of doing it, certain things that you would want to look for as the artist, I guess? What would you recommend?
Yeah, and this comes up a lot, actually. And it's weird because I definitely do answer it as someone who has done that job for so long, as opposed to answering it as a casting director, which obviously I am. And we will talk about that. Otherwise, I think everyone's going to think, why have I tuned in? We've probably lost everybody that's an actor.
Well, no. I doubt it, because we're talking about the agent side and the representation, and that's equally important.
But yeah, no, I think it's really important, and I talk about it all the time. And lots of actors come and say, you know, is it the level of the agent? I should be with this level of agent because that's going to get me in here, and those are the ones you talk to. And there's a whole other answer to that, which is that I talk to every agent, whoever they are. All my breakdowns go out to everybody, so that's not really relevant for me and the work that I do. But also, actually, I would always be prioritizing the relationship between you guys over that anyway. That, you know, because they're working with you and for you, and they need to understand how to market you, the sorts of work that you want to do, the sort of strengths that you have, to sort of, you know, manage your expectations realistically, but also push you when they can, but, you know, be very honest. So I think it's it's a really important relationship. And I think we always go, when we hear actors say, oh, I'm too scared to phone, I don't want to be a pain, or, you know, it's like, well, then you need to get someone that you're not scared to phone.
A little bit of that is probably British politeness as well.
Yeah.
I'm British. I can say that too. I've had that. I mean, I had to kick it out. But
kick it out.
There's elements of that. I mean, I think as well, I'm going back to when I was starting out and imagining now from the point of view of a fresh grad or someone who's just been a few years in the game. And I do think there can be a very easy path to go down where you think, I have to impress them, or I have to, you know, and I get that. And I don't know the right way of how you get out of that beyond just experience, I think, and growing in life experience, but it's important.
Yeah, and it's time, I'm sure, and it's just, you know, and they know that too. I mean, agents are great. I mean, obviously, we work really well with agents. We like each other. That's the idea. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they know that. They know that there's that expectation, and I think it's a shared thing, isn't it? To kind of, yeah, just, it takes time to get over those nerves, I guess. You know, back to your dating analogy, you know, it's that too, isn't it? Too much effort, throwing everything at it in the first 2 months, and then calming down and shifting into what is actually a much more natural friendship and relationship. So I think, yeah.
Absolutely.
Courtney will shout anything at me now. It's,
well, that's it, though. It's a collaboration, I think, is the thing. And you need to be able to have honest, open conversations that go both ways, and not run off in a huff and disappear for the weekend when you get your ego bruised or something.
And it is tough, you know, we all know how tough it is. It's really, you know, you guys haven't chosen the easiest path. I know it's the one you love.
Sure. Yeah, but I think on the flip side, what is easy anymore, like in terms of career path and job for life, like this whole period is showing that to many, that job security, I mean, you know, job security, what does that mean? And it is one of the questions that actually came in loosely, actually, to relate to that, which is, I think I know what the answer to this is, but let's get your opinion. You know, is there some kind of stigma or bad perception of knowing that an actor has a full-time job in something else? Would that potentially make you think that they're less committed or less interested to their artistry?
Look at the way I've talked before. Absolutely not. And I think, you know, there was a hideous piece in one of the trashy newspapers, tabloids recently here, sort of trying to shame an ex soap opera actress for having a second job. You know, a kind of where is she now type of thing. thing because she worked in, as a security or did some, I think it was security she was doing. And every single one of us, I mean, it just, social media went mad about it. Just, you know, and I think it provided a really, a definite kind of platform for us to shout from the rooftops. Not, absolutely not, you know. I mean, quite the reverse, actually. I think it's really healthy. I think it's necessary. There are very few actors that have the luxury of either working so much that they don't need a second job or having the luxury of support from elsewhere so that they don't need a second job. I personally, and I'm sure I speak for loads of casting directors, would not ever only want to see people that live those kind of lives. I'm very interested to see actors that do, you know, that are making it in whatever way they can. You know, we try to factor that in. I mean, obviously you need to be, the only things I would say is you know, be really clear with your agents when you can and can't attend auditions, because that can be super frustrating if you've gone through, you know, 400 submissions and you find out, you know, X percent of them aren't available on that day. But, you know, if I know this, I mean, there's plenty of times where if an agent subs and makes a note, like she's or he's on a shift that time and, you know, is there any chance he can see later in the day or first, we'll always try to factor that in the same way that we would with childcare or anything else. So I think the truth is, let us know. It absolutely would never be a barrier to me. Absolutely the opposite. If I'm truly honest, I think it can be opposite. For social reasons, I mean, I can't imagine a world where we only saw actors that didn't need to, you know.
It's impossible. Yeah. It's just impossible. I mean, there's people I know that work in what we would maybe label as the traditional professions that also have second jobs or side hustles, and they have the steady income. And I just think, I believe maybe that there was a stigma about it going way back.
Maybe.
Perhaps. But now it's even, was it a few years ago, the guy who used to work on the Cosby Show, who they had pictures of him where he was working in like a Trader Joe's or something. And it was the same thing where it's like, well, what do you expect?
Yeah. What's the point? Yeah. But also, what's the point you're making that he or she shouldn't support themselves and shouldn't support their family? And, you know, that's insane.
Yeah. The starving artist kind of moniker is not a glamorous one to try and. To try and pursue.
It's not a good look, really, either. I think also it's not good for people's mental health. You know, I think having second jobs and having insight into other worlds and hanging out with people that aren't actors all the time, not that you're not a lovely bunch, but, you know, that's probably all those things I think inform good humans and rounded people who make great actors. So I would never have an issue about that.
And on that point, in terms of people with other skills, this has been asked before. People have said, like, oh, well, I've been a police officer, or I've worked in this, or I've worked in that, but I never really talk about it. Like, the question normally then comes, okay, well, what would be the best way to accentuate that? Say it is something like, I've been a cop, or I worked in a bank. Would you put that somewhere, like, on Spotlight in the description? Would you just tell the agent to let them know?
I think when someone's, I mean, generally, I think the most helpful way that's come to me, and it does sometimes, is that if I put a job out and that's part of the character's story, then quite often the agent will say, by the way, you know, so-and-so has done this or spent 5 years, or an actor I spoke to the other day, I trained as a lawyer, you know, I kind of made a mental note of that and then went away and put it on my notes later. I didn't know that about him. It was just we were chatting on a one-to-one, and I was like, oh, that's really nice to know that. You know, just, yeah, I think those things are really, I wouldn't necessarily be, I mean, some people do put it under their extra skills and stuff on Spotlight, but I think it's actually the most sort of helpful way to be told about something like that is actually in the process of when it's, you know, relevant to a role, and then just letting me know that obviously is really handy.
Sure. Awesome. I have more questions here, but I can see that people are in the waiting room. So instead of making them wait, let's give you a break from me and let's bring them in and let them ask whatever they got to ask. So this should be, hopefully, Giancarlo, I hope.
Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good, thank you. Have you got video by any chance, or do you want to hide from us?
No, I do have. I thought it was... Okay. Here it is.
Now, there we go. Now we can see.
How
are you?
Okay.
Hi, nice to see you. How are you doing?
Nice to see you too. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for letting us ask the questions.
Absolute pleasure.
Cool. I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let you have your time. So, Giancarlo, take it.
All right. Thank you. So, Nikki, well, my question is regarding our international actors' accents and how to use it, not as a disadvantage, because so many people would think, okay, that's a disadvantage, but it could be an advantage. So I would like to know your opinion on this and maybe talk a little bit about the community. I am Latin American, I'm from Venezuela, and there is a big community. We have done the Latin American season at the Actors Center that is paused because of the COVID. And, well, yeah, maybe talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, no, I don't think you should ever use anything that's your part of who you are as a disadvantage, never be seen as a disadvantage, absolutely not. I mean, you know, there are times where it will be relevant in a storyline, in which case I would absolutely be looking to cast as authentically as I could. So, you know, if you're based in London, that's a huge advantage to me to be able to do that. And also just in general stories, we would always try to, you know, if someone's, you know, people move around, people don't live
anymore. Exactly.
So that can be told in many ways in stories. And I think we see that, and it's a really positive thing in casting. I mean, I know that something that went out recently that we all absolutely loved, the only comments I heard that were, and they weren't really negative at all because everybody loved it, but a few people said that they thought they should have seen more nationalities in some of the scenes where it was around a university. And I probably agree with that, actually. I think because in a normal university, you would see lots of different nationalities. So I think, you know, it can be a part of a story that, you know, the world is, you know, hopefully still there will be free movement again. You know, we do move around, we don't stay where we were born, and that will come into play in general stories where someone's you know, where they're from isn't necessarily labelled. And also when we actually specifically need someone to be from that part of the world, then it's fantastic for us to be able to cast great actors that, you know, because it's not just about your accent, it's about the because people can go to accent coaches and, you know, work on accents and all of those things. But, you know, it's about the intonation and the flow and your rhythms and all of those things and the kind of habits that people have that with different dialects. And so all of those things are lovely when they're authentic and natural. So, yeah, I think you should be marking it on your spotlight if people do searches. You know, letting people know what your native accent is always.
So you think producers and showrunners and, you know, head office are more open to cast international actors in plays that are not necessarily, like, if you're in London, you could be from anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
You think they're more open to that?
I think so. I mean, do you mean specifically in theatre or do you mean in film?
No, not necessarily. Film or the screen?
So for screen, yes. I think they are. I mean, unless there's a specific storyline. I mean, often I'm working in factual drama, so sometimes the story will dictate.
Of course.
You know? But then that also works to your advantage. You know, I did a big series with a Damien Lewis thing where the stories were global, so we really needed to find people, and we wanted that, again, to feel really authentic. So, you know, it works both ways. But yes, I think people are open to that. I mean, stories should reflect what's truthful and what happens. And,
of course.
And, you know, you are living in London. You are here. So why would you be in a story that was made and centered around? I mean, I think Gangs of London does that brilliantly.
Yeah, I was doing my research. You know,
That's a really international story.
Yeah. And the Italian market could be around. The Latino market could be around.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. So hopefully that's a positive answer, but that's definitely a truthful answer as far as I'm concerned. The only time, I wouldn't say to you, you know, that I think you should spend hours working on your Cockney or your RP or your Northern British accent. I don't think that's necessarily realistic, but I think all of the other reasons for you being cast are absolutely realistic.
All right. Thank you so much, Nikki. Very nice to meet you.
You too. Pleasure. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Ashley.
No worries. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, it's one that comes up quite a bit, Nikki,
leave the meeting?
If you don't mind. I mean, you can. Normally people don't chill.
I could stay.
You can stay. You can be the new host. Take it easy. Yeah, people normally ask that question of, should I focus on my niche, say in his case where he's Venezuelan, should I focus on being like the Latino Venezuelan speaker and that's it, but it's a smaller pool of opportunities, or should I learn RP, or if I'm in the States, learn American because I want to go out for more? And it's kind of six and one half a dozen, but I suppose what you're saying is, own your niche.
But I would also say, I mean, American's interesting. I would say there's more chance, particularly from a UK perspective, if he, you know, if he, it depends what he's comfortable with and how close he can get. I mean, he needs to be, but then it needs to be flawless. So, I mean, when I say flawless, you know, people's accents change slightly for where they move around to. So, you know, I think whatever feels like it could naturally have happened is relevant. But I think it's a big leap to go from a sort of strong Venezuelan accent to, yeah, Cockney, RP, Northern. But, you know, there might be ways that you could imagine that he might have moved around. I think, you know, it depends on the story, but I would definitely be focusing more on where your strength is and the truth of the accent that you can do really truthfully.
Sure. And also, I guess, just because logistically, there's so many great British actors that are British. You're going to go to them, right? Cool. Let's bring in the next person. So this is Sophia. Lots of international people. We're all over.
It's nice. I've been like that on the one-to-ones, which has been
really
lovely. Yeah, really nice.
Hello.
Hi, Sophia. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you guys?
Good.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming. Have you got video by any chance or not?
I'm in the video. Oh, sorry. I thought I was in my best smile.
That's the same as the last person said, so maybe it's Zoom just being annoying.
Hey,
yeah, I'm here.
Now we can see you.
I love you to meet you.
I love you to meet you. How are you guys?
Yeah, good. I'm good. Yeah, you?
I'm good, thank you. I got an excuse today to do my makeup and go in the video.
I think this is the first hair wash in about 4 days.
Same.
I didn't know my hair was this colour.
and as the man on this, I'm just going to keep quiet.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, Sophia, I'm going to leave you to just have a chat with Nikki. So it's your time to.
All right. Thank you so much. So should I just ask the question now?
Go for it. What's your question?
Yeah. Sure. Well, Nikki. This is basically a question I keep asking because I'm sort of exploring the UK industry as a foreign actress at the minute. I'm not quite sure where I'm standing yet, if it makes sense. So I would ask you, what are your thoughts about the representation of Latin American actors in the UK, in UK productions, basically?
Yeah, interestingly, we just talked about something very similar just now. And I think it's basically, you know, obviously it depends on the story, depends on who's working on what. But I think, you know, there's no reason why, I mean, the world is, you know, people move around. There are relevant stories about people from different parts of the world set in the UK or, you know, set elsewhere that might be being cast in the UK. I mean, specifically, I can't say that, you know, I have a huge turnover of work that is specifically targeted at Latin American actors, but I've certainly cast, you know, I've done a couple of biopics where that was important. I've done a series last year with Damian Lewis where we had storylines that were global and there was a brilliant Latin American storyline and we wanted to cast authentically actors from that part of the world. So I think, as we were just talking to Jannie a minute ago and talking about a similar thing, I think it's obviously really important to on your casting profile, presumably if you're on Spotlight and things like that, you know, to mark where you're from but where you're based, if you're based in the UK but you know you have languages, accents, all of those things are really important. And you know, really nice showreel footage that shows you know, acting with, you know, English dialogue and also in your native language is also really useful as well for me. You know, if it's great footage, I mean, the most important thing is that it needs to be really strong content in terms of performance.
Perfect. So would you say, like, for us, it's an advantage in a way to be here as a foreign actor, as a Latin American actor? Would it be like ideal to just keep like I would say like our accent, just keep the approach as a foreign actor to the industry? Is this like?
Yeah, I mean, I'd always, again, this, I mean, I'm just speaking from my own, the work that I do. So I mean, you know, other casting directors may, depending on the work that they do, may give you slightly different answers. But for me personally, yeah. I mean, for me, it would always be authentic casting. So okay. I think it's really important to, you know, wear that proudly. And obviously look at your other accents that you're comfortable with, if they're close, you know, if they work in terms of proximity and they work in terms of storylines and stuff. But I see no reason why, I mean, the same thing as I said before. I
think. Perfect. As a casting director, you sometimes get that freedom in auditions process, like, to decide, because some of the breakdowns are without, like, a specific ethnicity. Does the casting directors got that freedom of decide maybe, oh, well, you know, this is like certain actors are going to be for this project? Or it's just specifically not, or it's always from the director, like, oh, no, I want this specific ethnicities in this project? Or
I think we would always try to keep that as wide open as possible. And I think casting directors, we always talk about this, and I've certainly pushed against casting that I felt hasn't been diverse enough, particularly, okay. You know, in not so much now, but, you know, years ago in commercials, I found I was pushing a lot on that, and positively so, you know, being able to bring people in and going against perhaps a brief that had been given by the client or the director, more usually the client rather than the director, on the commercial side. So yes, I think we do try to do that. Recently I did it with a short film. I was asked to read a script and I read it, and it was a lovely script. I felt like that it would be far more interesting if one of the two leads was female and also a woman of colour. So, and I presented that to the writer and said, what do you think? Like, the dynamic would be really interesting if you read it in this way and we did it in different. So, I mean, I'm not really a sort of shouty kind of do it this way kind of.
Of course.
But you can gently suggest and steer. So there are times where I would actively do it if I felt that everything was a little bit too narrow in terms of the brief. Other times we just do it naturally when it's not noted. You know, we would just approach all those characters with a very open mind that they could come from different parts of the world and be relevant in that story, that they could be different ethnicities and be relevant in that story. Why not? You know, that's what the world looks like. So unless there's a very rigid reason, which for drama documentary often there is a reason if it's based on a true person, then obviously in those situations I can't change the ethnicity or the accent of somebody, and we need to play
like that. A historical drama.
Yeah, exactly. We play that to the truth, and we would always do that. But again, that can also be an advantage, because if that person happens to be from a certain part of the world, then we'll be casting it that way. I think we try to, yeah, we try to keep it open where we can. I mean, of course, we would, yeah.
Okay. Oh, good. Do you have any, like, a preference for agents, for, like, to work with certain agents, or you kind of, or you work through a spotlight with any?
Yeah. I work with everybody, so, which is lovely, because it means that, you know, I get to see lots of different actors, and it doesn't matter who their agent is, and that's quite reflected in the castings that we hold, and also, you know, in our final cast on things, you'll see actors from that are in them are represented by all sorts of different agents, and a couple of not represented at all. So, you know, it's about who's right for the job, basically, as far as, yeah. I mean, obviously, I have to know about them. I have to see them, so they have to have a presence. They have to be on spotlight, or I have to see them play or something. So, you know, I'm not sort of. I don't want to be unrealistic about that. There are still places from which I have to, you know, take my ideas. But generally, I would try to keep it as open and fair as I could.
Okay, thank you so much, Nikki. I don't know how. I think I was allowed to just one question, maybe. Ash isn't gonna be happy about it. No.
All right. No, it's giving me a breather, and Nikki didn't have to listen to me talking for much longer. No, no. It's all good. Thank you for thank you for coming
on.
Thank
you, Nikki.
Bye.
Bye. The spotlight thing, Nikki. So you mentioned obviously about, you know, you obviously put your breakdowns out there. For people that aren't represented, of which there's, you know, quite a few, are your breakdowns some of the ones that you can see if you're not repped? And if that's not the case, how can people?
It is really tricky that, and I really agonize over it for all the reasons that, you know, up until this question, obviously, all my answers very truthfully have been as you know, trying to cast the net as wide as I can. See what I did there. But the going on to the actor's pay, it's difficult that because I have
it opens it up really wide, doesn't it?
Yeah. It opens it up really wide, but also I'll just be really honest. But I've done it a few times and it's been a bit of a disaster in that lots of people submitting themselves when they're not right and saying, I know I'm not quite right for this, but I just wanted to say hello. Other people writing direct to the director. And I've heard other casting directors talk about that too, which obviously is really tricky for us, you know, not because we're trying to be gatekeepers or anything mad like that, but just because that's just awkward, you know, when that happens. So because of that, I have struggled a little bit with doing that because it does increase my workload massively when I'm going through lots of inappropriate subs. So I don't know what the way to overcome that was is. And with some projects, I do that. Some projects, I do still post it to the actors board and I'll put a little note saying, please, please, please. I look at every single submission, I genuinely do. So please only sub if you've really read the brief and you're right for it, because I won't remember you for something else from you submitting, you know, inappropriately. I just won't. I'll just remember that that was a bit of pain at that moment. I was trying not to.
Yeah,
not
but to it makes sense that if you're casting someone who is supposed to be, you know, let's take an example of Giancarlo, supposed to be South American Venezuelan, and someone, you know, writes it and says, well, I'm British, but I could do that. And you don't look anything like the, especially with what you're doing as well, right? Because it's got to be.
Yeah. It's really important. And just also ages, you know, people are putting themselves forward in the wrong age group, all of that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, I do think about that question a lot. And there's another casting director that I'm really good friends with, and we talk about it a lot and trying to find ways that we could try and just manage that situation better. The way that I try to do it is that I will try to, I look at Showreel Share Day a lot on Twitter. I try to find other ways to find unrepresented actors. I still try to find those people, whether it's through going to Vault Festival plays or whether it is, I'm a really big fan of Kate's Showreel Share Day on Twitter. Right. I think it's a great thing to do. And, you know, I'm happily will spend a few hours looking through those, and there's lots of unrepped actors there. So, yeah, I do try, but we need to find a better way that system works so that people sub sensibly. Because it's not fair for all the people that do sub sensibly. I know that it's going to be really frustrating to hear this, but it is a fact that it's
true. I don't know the answer to that because it's human. Just human, right? Like, how can we? Yeah. We can't police that.
No, I guess it's just us being really clear and just trying to say we're on your side.
But to your point, sometimes it's not about your clarity. It's just that someone thinks, because we actors think we can do everything.
I know.
It's going to be that.
Often you can. You know.
Yeah, you know, I'll come in and be like, Nikki, I can play 18. What are you talking about? I'll play 18. Like this is a gray hair. This is just like a fashion statement. That's all that is.
In a dark theatre.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. What are you trying to say? Stick to radio. And one of the questions, you've kind of, I think, answered it, but I'll ask because there might be other strands to it. It is about that idea of how do you go about finding new talent. I was going to say, aside from obviously spotlight submissions, now you've mentioned theatre, you mentioned Showreel Share Day, which are obviously big ones. Are there any other kind of like, ways that you
I mean, I'm always looking at short films. I think that's a really lovely way to do it. I follow other casting directors and I try and steal their ideas because they're brilliant, and I have loads of casting director crushes on people, and you know, fiercely watch all their work, and then kind of write names down really quickly. So yeah, I do it. I mean, obviously, they, you know, and that might be small things that they've done, so that isn't just the obvious stuff, because by then people aren't unknown anymore. But yeah, I try to look in all sorts of places, you know. But I mean, and sometimes I do, I mean, quite often I'll do searches on Spotlight as well, actually. I mean, I probably should have said this to the international actors. I'll do searches for international quite a lot, you know, to try and find actors that have specific accents or, you know, come from a certain part of the world. I'll try to do that. So that can often throw up actors that I haven't seen before or that unrepped and stuff. And then I would reach out to them via Spotlight. I mean, I only tend to use Spotlight as a casting platform. I don't tend to use many of the others, actually. So I'm probably not spreading myself out in those places. But, you know, every now and again, I've put stuff out on Twitter. Obviously, that's huge when it comes back. And I'm like, I'm buried for about 5 days. But, you know, I try to.
Because Spotlight, obviously, as we've always kind of known, is the big one, right? Like, for any actor that's starting out, you know, there's so many things you can focus on. There's so many kind of bells and whistles and possible things you could invest time and money into. Beyond, obviously, the obvious thing of, like, have a headshot, would you then say that getting yourself on Spotlight and having enough credits to do that should be your main focus?
Yeah, absolutely. And then for me, it's real material as well. I think, you know, I really need reels for what I do. So I have spent lots of time during this, you know, the one-to-ones and just talking about people's reels and, you know, how they can make them the best they can, and doesn't necessarily have to be these, you know, super expensive polished reels and stuff. But I think, yeah, all of these tools are just really important, just because at the stage where I don't know you, those are all the things that are going to inform me as to whether or not I can get you to self-tape. And I think we will be asking more people to self-tape through this. I mean, I think that's the joy of self-tape, and that's the other thing that I've been trying to be really positive about self-tape, is that, you know, we can ask for more self-tapes than we can invite people in. So, you know, I know they take, obviously I'm not underestimating how much time they take you guys to do and to prep for, especially when it's someone as demanding as me who asks you to take ages to prep for it, but it doesn't take us that long to watch, so it's really good. I can watch more, I can watch it again, I can think about it, I can revisit it, I can then make one short list and watch them all again, you know. So all of those things are you know, really, really important tools, I think. And I mean I know there have been other casting directors that have talked about this as well, but I've been saying through this period as well, I think in terms of just getting back to a toolkit, I think we talked earlier about, you know, the self-tape thing. I think it's also quite nice to have a few, like, little Vimeo pieces, if you're really proud of them, just in your pocket for when you or your agent approach a casting director with a specific project in mind, to say, even if it isn't evident from my showreel, although I would always say only have brilliant stuff on your showreel anyway, you know, you can send that as an additional thing. So, again, those are all really nice tools for people to have.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because obviously there's that whole thing of, first of all, how long should my showreel be? And then what should I put on my showreel and in what order? And that's changed. I remember it used to be, you know, 5 minutes, then three. Now it's like very Americanized. It's almost 2 to 3 tops. What about the footage itself? So obviously people have different types of footage. They've maybe not worked on projects that are big in name. Maybe some have. What would your suggestion be in terms of that first thing that you put on there?
Again, I'm going to do my disclaimer thing to say this is...
In your opinion.
Although I do know that there's a lot of casting directors that feel the same, which is really nice, because I've heard them saying similar things, and I've been saying this for ages. Because I don't come from that old school set of rules, I don't come to it with any of those things. So for me personally, I don't care how long it is. I mean, I'd rather it wasn't too long, but I mean, in terms of, I don't care how short this is, I would rather see 30 seconds to a minute of brilliance than 2 minutes of bland filler. Sure. I mean, I kind of do that whole music back to that side of my life, all killer, no filler, please. Take a really critical eye to it. Don't put up anything. I'm always shocked at how many actors, when I talk to them on these one-to-ones and I talk about their reels and go, you know, what do you think of that scene? And they go, don't really like it actually, but I just felt like I needed to get it in. And I was like, out it goes. If you don't like it, I'm almost certainly not going to like it. I think the content is so important to me, and all I really want to see is that someone is completely invested in that role, whatever it is. I just want to see brilliant performance. I'm really not fussed about the quality of the filming or the, you know, I don't want to see how many short films you've done on a showreel just to show me. I can see that from your credits. If they're not great roles for you, not very well made, and it's, you don't think your performance is brilliant, I'd rather not see them. I'd rather you showed me a brilliant self-tape. I genuinely would. And I have brought people in on that basis, and someone who got a job for a Netflix thing that I did just before Christmas, she didn't have any professional credit. She didn't have a professional showreel. She had a piece that her mate had filmed, and it was really powerful. It was really, really powerful. And I knew she was really good just from that. And then I asked her to self-tape, and of course she was great. And then she came in along with, you know, the other actors that I brought in for it, and she blew us all away. So, you know, that was literally a self-tape that she'd done. Just the content was perfect for her, and she was completely invested in it, and the performance just absolutely, you know, was lovely. And that's all I want, really. I think
The performance is key, right? Oh no, yeah, I'd like to think by now that people know that the montage thing isn't anything other than the filler that you spoke about.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so. Because, you know, and big caricatured characters as well, they don't really do it for me. I mean, I've got a background in comedy, so I love comedy. I'm not just all about the serious, you know, heart-wrenching stuff. Although I do love gritty, heart-wrenching stuff. But, you know, I love comedy, but the best comedy is truthful, rooted in truth. And so these big caricatures, you know, big different accents, big earrings for certain accents, and that doesn't really do it.
Yeah, it's a nuanced screen performance, yeah, which has some kind of connection to the material, the other people in the scene. What about, because now the other flip side is, you know, people start working, they get a few small little jobs here and there, but in some known projects or they're with a named actor, but maybe they've only got one line and it's like 10 seconds. Now, that doesn't really show much of your performance and your ability, per se, because it's a throwaway line. Yeah. But it's that hard question then that actors debate over of, well, do I put that at the beginning because it shows that I could be trusted to work in this project, or do I put the performance first and leave that for later just because, you know, which was your opinion on that?
I mean, even if it is just one line, I would say it should be in there. I mean, again, I would still be more steered by an incredible performance than I would be that you were stood next to Brad Pitt or whoever. I don't know why I said Brad Pitt. I've been locked away for 10 weeks.
There we go. Someone's watching. You're going to watch Troy or Fight Club tonight or something now.
I'm sure that I meant to say Stephen Graham. I don't know why I said Brad Pitt.
The British version of Brad Pitt.
But yeah, I think, you know, that's a really tricky one. I guess, again, you know, of course there will be some people, I'll probably look at that and go, oh, that's good. Yeah, I would. You know, I mean, I saw a lovely actress the other day, or I was looking at her for something, and she had played the young Maxine Peake in Funny Cow, and that was just a lovely scene. But already I was kind of engaged because of the credits, because it's just a lovely, you know. So of course it makes a difference, but it had to be a lovely scene as well, you know. So I think it's just getting it right. Yeah, I probably would put it in, but I certainly wouldn't put loads of that stuff in with just another one of you walking by, or, you know, one at the back of your head, you know, because I've sort of seen that with people like going, oh, that was a massive feature film, so I'll put three different scenes from that in.
It's almost like pick the one,
nippet, pick the one.
And maybe if you have five little bits like that from different projects, pick one that really, I guess, stands out, and then go into performance, because...
But I also think, like, we're not silly, you know, credits are credits, you know, I can see a credit, it doesn't need to be that literal for me, you know, I can see a credit, I can see that a director's trusted you and that you've done that, again, I'm still more interested in seeing you acting with something that you can really get your teeth into, a character that really suits you. That's still going to be the thing that pulls me in, rather than the fact that you stood next to so-and-so and said yes as you've opened a door.
Yeah. Goddamn Brad Pitt. Obviously, so the good stuff, obviously, we want on the reel, but sometimes, you know, we may have new stuff to put on there, and then something that's really good just comes off it because we've, over time, accumulated more material. And we want to have newer stuff on there that's equally good and shows who we are now, not who we were 6 years ago.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, that being said, that thing from 5, 6 years ago could still show you in a certain role that's quite specific. So is this where you would then advise have that on YouTube or on Vimeo? Because maybe there is that period drama that you have the footage for that you could show, or maybe there's you as a soldier.
Yeah. I would say you can do it a couple of different ways, the way that it's worked for me, because this has come up a lot, where it'll either be as a, sent to me by the agent in the subject header as a link, you know, see them in so-and-so, or it'll be, if it's been a really lovely role and it's 5 years ago, it'll be as a separate, that you know, underneath the showreel.
In spotlight.
With the dates on it, you know. That also works. I mean, you know, I'm happy to look, if someone's done, I mean, that happened not that long ago where I looked at something that someone had done from a series 4 years ago. And I actually remembered the series anyway, but they were, you know, they're quite young. So it was, but it was really lovely to just be reminded of, actually, that's really nice. And she didn't have a huge part in it, but it was, you know, she popped up in a few scenes and they were nice scenes. So
that's an interesting one. If we can flip the sort of mirror on Spotlight a bit, because obviously we don't see Spotlight in the same way that casting will see it. So obviously you, I know, can filter for whether someone has a showreel or not, which is a huge thing. Yeah. When you then get that through, what do you actually see? Because I know headshots are like thumbnails for you. You barely see it. So, what does the showreel side look like? Will you just see that one reel to click on? Would you see any sub-videos that people have on?
Or do you have so first of all, you'll get all your submissions will come to you, and then you'll click on them, and then that will take you to the page. And on the page, then you see everything. And there's obviously, when you get the submissions, the agents will have a little box that they can put a comment in. And that comment could be something like, you know, Ash used to be a brain surgeon, did you know? He's perfect for this. And, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, the other things would be,
nobody should let me anywhere near a scalpel or their brain in that order.
You just looked completely like,
Why not? Yeah, bro. I mean, my dad was Iranian, so the whole thing that they always ankled on was either you're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. I'm neither, but now if you want to anoint me as a surgeon, he'd be happy.
I don't know. Again, I don't know where this stuff's coming from.
Right.
You should have done this at the beginning of lockdown.
I'm going to write this down as an idea to pitch. It's going to be Brad Pitt as a brain surgeon.
As a brain surgeon, yeah. Please let me cast it.
Go for it.
But yeah, so there's lots of ways that the agents can do that, and that can go in that. But to be honest, I always, and again, disclaimer, I always click on submissions. I don't just go on headshots, because headshots, you know, are such a tiny part of the story. So for me, I would, and also you get them really small. So depending on someone's skin tone, it you know, it's not all the headshots translate that well when they're tiny, so I would click on them, I would see them bigger, I would go through them, then I'd go to the showreel. So I'm looking at two things, and actually yesterday I spoke to an actress who's amazing, and I looked at her headshots in exactly the way that I would have liked to prep to speak to her. I always look at everyone's reels before I talk to them, on the Spotlight ones when I know who's calling. And I just said, my God, like from your headshots, I thought you were a commercials actress. Beautiful, but quite glam shots, loads of them. Clicked on the reel, it was like, she's incredible actor. You know, really serious, really gritty, really beautiful, you know, quite intense drama. And I was like, wow, okay, that's, you maybe need to look at that, because I would have clicked always, because I would make sure, but I was not expecting that. So
and not everyone would click. click. That's the other thing, most likely.
Yeah, it depends how busy you are. It depends who's doing it. I mean, I do them myself, so I'm kind of a little bit, like, control freak about that. Like, I want to see everything in case I miss somebody. But, you know, so yeah. I mean, there's something in that. There's a definite message. There's a difference. It's such a hard thing to describe, that difference. But there is obviously a difference in what looks like a traditional drama headshot and what looks like more of a commercials headshot. And it's a really subliminal judgment that you try not to be making. But I definitely made it yesterday.
But it goes down to all kinds of things, right? It could be down to what you're wearing, the background.
The different outfits. I mean, she had a different outfit on in it, some with glasses, some without, some with hair up, it was just very geared towards what I would say that usually, like, when you're scrolling through the commercials, that's really helpful to have all that stuff. But yeah, it was just really interesting to look completely different. So from my point of view, yeah, I'd look at everything, but yeah, we see that small picture.
Gotcha.
So make sure that small picture is
as representative of you as possible as well, right? And with the video footage, just quickly, last one on that. So for people that, for example, like the guys on before that speak different languages, for example, they speak Spanish, or people that speak French, Italian, whatever, would you say it's worthwhile having a separate reel, or at least footage, or a bit of self-tape content or whatever of you speaking that language to pull out?
Yeah, and I think I would probably say, just to be helpful, it would be, just to cover all bases, probably have it as a separate one, have them over the top of it, you know, have the UK English dialogue, and then whatever their native language is on as a second one. Because then whatever you're looking for, you just go to the one you need. If you need it to be English but with that accent, or you need it to actually be as an Italian speaker or a Spanish speaker.
Yeah. Perfect. Resumes. What about resumes or CVs? Sorry. What about CVs? I mean, what's your view on that? A lot of people just put everything on there. What's your view on that?
I think don't put everything on there. Put the stuff you're proud of on there. I think don't be scared of. I know there's been lots of different opinions on whether you should, if you're pushing towards doing screen, you should take some of your stage ones off. I think the fact that lots of casting directors talk about that shows that there is an argument for doing that. I mean, again, these are conversations that I would have with your agent, depending on where you want to steer your career. Again, disclaimer, me, I don't mind how many stage credits you've got. I'm quite interested to see that you've been at the Old Vic, or you've been at the Bush, or you've been at the Vaults, and, you know, which director did that, or who it's written by, if I might know it. I'm quite interested in that. It's definitely not a barrier to me. But if the types of drama that you're going for, the different types of screen stuff you want to be seen for, if your agent thinks that is, you know, slanting things too much, then I think those are the conversations to have together. And if you haven't got an agent, then I would say look at all of those credits and just make sure that they're good ones, you know. I mean, there was an actor the other day that wanted to take a read-through. He was like, oh, I think I might take this read-through off. And I was like, no, don't take it off. It's a really nice play, and it's a really high profile read through because it was with the other actors that ended up, you know, and you're very new, so for you to even get to do that read through informs me that you did something really good. So I think it's not really a one size fits all answer. Yeah. I think it's based on how good your credits are. I mean, I don't think you need to fill every tab. I would definitely try to keep them, you know, as neat and tidy as you can. And, you know, things like if you've been in 3 series of something, you just put the dates, you don't have to list it 3 times.
Yeah, I guess it is what you're saying, calibrating where you are in your own journey as well. Yeah. A little bit, right?
It's so much more succinctly than me, sorry.
No, I gave me no, I was just I was just processing how to say it. Well, when you're a brain surgeon, when you're a brain surgeon, I guess words just come to you. I don't know.
Definitely my interpreter, and I just ramble on. You just put it in a few words that everyone can understand.
Hey, if you ever need the service, it's here. I'm just seeing if there's any more questions that I haven't asked that people have sent in. I asked about the resume. No, nothing on here bar the last one, which was generally just what's your favorite part about casting?
I'm gonna sound so cheesy if I say all of it, but it is, because I get really excited when the job comes in, and if it's something that I'm, yeah, especially if it's a team that I really love working with. And I'm really lucky that I get to work with the same team on a lot of the docudramas that I do, and I just love them. We've just got such a lovely rhythm of working together, so that's always exciting. And then seeing that first script and working out who the roles are. I won't lie, I always get excited when there are more female roles, because for years that wasn't the case. I mean, it's never that there's more, but just more than the last job is still an advantage. So that's always exciting. Yeah, I love the self-tape process. I love it when they come back and I've got a feeling about someone and it comes in and I go, yeah, I knew it. I knew that was going to be good. Obviously, the sessions themselves are lovely, and giving someone a job is, everybody says that's their best bit. You know, that's so nice, making that call. And I try to, well, not try to, I do. I always do a yes or no, whatever. For self-tapes and for people who come in, and that's for commercials as well as drama. So, you know, I'll always, there'll always hopefully be a nice tie-up at the end of every project anyway, and that I'll be able to be saying, that was a really lovely self-tape and I really loved it, or that was such a great audition and I'm so sorry it didn't work out, but I promise you that we don't forget, which is completely true. And I mean, that does get proven over the years that people do see. And it's not just that I might bring that person in, but the director might work with another casting director and say, I love so-and-so from the job that I did with Nikki, and then they bring them in. And so there is this lovely little spreading of sort of good vibes.
It's nice to hear that, because it's come out a lot with a lot of people in the last sort of month or two when I've been talking about that notion of you do the audition, you might not be right for it, you might not get it. There's so many different combinations as to why or why not. It's not even worth thinking about at all, because you'd go nuts as an actor.
Yeah.
But that everybody to a sort of, you know, T has said, well, we don't forget. And even if you've done a read that isn't great, we look at it and go, well, maybe that's because, you know, we brought them in, but actually perhaps they weren't quite right for that role, but it's not that they're bad, or maybe they had a bad day. Like, that's also a thing.
Yeah. I mean, that happens a lot, and I don't know if that's because of my artist management background, or I'm very on it for things like that. But, you know, there are times where someone will come in and I know that they usually do a better job than they've done on that day, and I'll definitely think about that. And, you know, like, there have been times where I've spoken to the director and gone, I'd quite like, you know, so-and-so to come back in, or you know, if we've got the luxury of that, or the agent will say, how was it? And I'll go, I just think his confidence has gone a little bit, or, you know, that happened recently, and she was like, oh, that makes sense, yeah, da, da, da. And I was like, okay. And that's a nice kind of looking after sharing of, there's not, it's not done enough, didn't do a very good job. It's more of a, what was up that day? That's not normal.
You know, yeah, we see there's like this big sort of piece of paper with black mark and a huge Sharpie, you know.
Black markers. Definitely red markers. It's like school. No. None at all. None of that. I mean, if someone comes in their room to the receptionist, or something, I always hear about it.
That's different. Again, that goes back to, it's the dating analogy. I've used this on the show so many times. It's the same thing. If you're rude to the waiter, and that just shows, you know, what you're probably going to be like in the long term. So it's the same thing. Do unto others, I suppose. Quick final question for me that's just come out of all that, and then we'll kind of sort of consolidate and wrap up. You talk about self-tapes being your sort of first step, which a lot of people are talking about more and more now, but you've done that historically, regardless of the situation. People do a self-tape, you like it, you then bring them in to meet in person. That's kind of the process. Now, for the actor who's done whatever they've done in the self-tape, they can then get in their head about, what do I now do when I go in person? You may have sent notes, you may have not sent notes. But that's the thing where people don't know whether to stick or shift. Do you change what you did? Do you do exactly the same and try and replicate lightning in a bottle?
When you come into a room, we always try to say, and I know it's really difficult because we're kind of like, be off book, learn it, but don't learn it, don't overlearn it. Do this, but don't be too committed, but be committed.
Be natural, so but not.
Don't be too natural. Yeah. Yeah, and I know, I've seen all the parody stuff. I know that we do that to you guys, sorry. But I think with the self-tape thing, your self-tape was obviously brilliant, which is why, and in my case, that really is the case, because with drama documentary particularly, we might sometimes get a couple of days, but we generally, I'm working on a huge self-tape thing to get it down to who actually comes in, and we don't have weeks and weeks and weeks on one role. So from that point of view, there should be a confidence that comes with that. So I would say on the first thing that people should come in and kind of work in a way that they did for the self-tape, the same perhaps informed kind of performance that they did without all the things that were in their head, and then just be open to any direction or anything that, you know, I mean, I'm not teaching you to suck eggs, you guys know all this, but that's how I would go from that process, that initially probably come in and work in a similar way that, you know, it worked. So don't, you know, suddenly come in and do something entirely different, because that will throw us all and go, oh wow, why has he done that? But, you know, and generally, like, if you've done two takes and you've gone down a very bold move with one and done one a different way, I would normally feed back when you came in and say, by the way, they've nailed it with take, you know, that's the tone that I was looking for the second take. So I would try to, I mean, obviously we want to give you as much as we can to make you be brilliant. So yeah, it's not like we're not sort of booby trapping it. So
that's what we all think when we get together in our meetings. You know, the group gets together and we all kind of say they're tricking us here. I did lie. I do have actually one more question. I'm doing a Columbo on you a little bit. Because you do a lot of obviously docudrama and it's factual based on real people, there's then that, I guess, extra pressure for you and the actor and everybody to honor who those real people are, depending on the project. But there's also, in some cases, I'm going to guess, footage that you can find of them on YouTube, or just you can find out, you know, which is great to study, but there's also that fine line of, I'm assuming you don't want someone just to mimic and copy.
No.
So how much of it is just, it's your essence is enough, bring you to the thing, you look close enough to them, as opposed to we need you to mimic them?
Yeah, no, I mean, the ones that we do, particularly the ones that I work on with the team that did Suffragettes and Henry, and I'm starting one about the Blitz that we were due to start just before lockdown, and I thought, I have no idea when this is going to come back, but actually in the last 24 hours, I've been speaking to the line producer, and we think we might be able to start at least talking about pre-production and casting, which is lovely.
Okay.
So on those jobs, yeah, we're absolutely looking for the essence of the performers. I'm not looking for lookalikes. Obviously, there needs to be some physical resemblance. But, I mean, these are battles that I've had with execs at only once. Biopics, in that, you know, we need to be casting the best actor that really, that, because no one's ever going to look like a very, very famous person. And if they've still got fans, those fans will be obsessed and they won't like it, whatever. So, you know, it's all about actually the audience just going with an incredible performance, and that's where we need to be casting. So from that point of view, apart from a couple of biopics that had a slightly different remit to them, all of the drama doc stuff that I'm doing is absolutely done from that really truthful point of view. I think what you said about honoring the real person is really important. That's why I love it so much, actually, because I feel like we, you know, in some of these stories there's still family members alive, or you know, or we're telling a really historical story like Henry VIII in a completely different way. You know, we're not doing a big caricature Henry. We're talking about this really sort of quite tortured man, and you know, all sorts of different things. So they've got a lovely kind of truth to them. So that's what I need from the actor. Yeah, I need them to, ethnicity wise, I have to be true to the character, and accent wise, I would also be really truthful. But fundamentally, it's about getting a lovely performance out of them.
Same as anything.
I mean, people keep asking why it's, you know, what's different about it, and there really isn't much that's different about it. That's why they're good, because we approach them in exactly the same way. The directors that I work with direct full dramas, you know, and films, you know, that's what they do. So we don't treat it any differently. The only thing is we have to split the budget with these wonderful historians on the documentary side, which is really exciting, but obviously does make it slightly different. But you know, that just means we can't fly people in from LA and things like that.
Awesome. Well, listen, Nikki, I wrap these up with 10 questions that I stole from James Lipton from Inside the Actor's Studio. So,
is this the test?
There's no test. It's just.
Oh.
Who said there was a test? So no, it's just he asks those questions at the end of each of his interviews, so it's a nice little one to rattle off. So just whatever comes to you, really, in the moment. So the first question is, what is your favorite word?
Oh, God, nothing's come. Some, I think, probably. Okay. Yeah.
You're in the wrong country. You know that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What's your least favorite word?
Gusset.
Say it again, because it broke up.
Gusset.
Gusset. I'm going to plead naivety and ignorance. What's gusset?
I can't even describe it without going red, but you said say whatever comes into your head.
Yeah.
It's okay. The bit of the tights that when you pull up.
Okay. I don't feel so bad about not knowing that now, to be fair. And you saved me from Googling it and probably finding images I didn't want to see.
Oh, sorry.
What turns you on in a creative, spiritual, intellectual kind of way?
Truthful, usually social commentary, whether that's music or art or film. Mm-hmm. My husband the same. The music that we listen to, the films we watch, the art that we love, it usually has some sort of political or social messaging, probably.
I mean, that's what art's about, right? Reflecting all kinds of humanity, but not shying away from the big conversation all the time.
I'm a bit of a marcher. I come from that kind of family, so yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. We need more of that now than ever, to be fair, so.
We do.
Virtual marches. We'll all march in Zoom.
Yeah.
What turns you off, sort of, from the same perspective, but on the flip side?
Probably caricature. I quite often find that quite insulting. Particularly, I don't really like people being sent up because of where they come from. So I'm not so keen on that whole kind of, caricature performances. I don't love heightened drama. It doesn't turn me off. I can see the brilliance of it, but I don't get as excited watching. My taste isn't particularly in that. I would much rather watch Calm with Horses than I would watch, a Marvel film. It's just not, and obviously I've watched enough of those with my kids and stuff. I do know the value of them and how brilliant they are, but if I'm talking about my own taste,
that's the thing. I think, the game we're in, well, forget the game, like life generally is just taste and opinions. Fifth question is optional because it's what's your favorite swear word? And
I love swearing.
Because you haven't sworn all through this, and you did say you did. And I was like, oh, did you? I was like, normally I swear like a chimney. I've not sworn either. What's your
favorite swear word is wanker.
Okay.
And the reason it's my favorite swear word is because I used to work with Billy Connolly, and he does a whole sketch, and I'm not going to do it because it's too embarrassing, and my kids, if they ever watch this, would just die that I talked about wanking. But if you think about the word, and you think about the rhythms of that word, it's quite funny. And Billy Connolly does a whole sketch on it and why he loves that word.
People are going to be YouTubing that sketch and try to find it.
Yeah, it's really, I don't know, I hope it's, I mean, he did it live. I'm sure it will be somewhere online.
People don't like everything.
The word and saying it's just a brilliant word.
I also like the fact that you're one of the few people that hasn't just said the word fuck as their favorite swear word, which is normally the one. And I get it. It's good. It's strong and interchangeable.
I use it a lot.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
You're asking for a favorite.
But I like that yours has a story behind it too. Like that's probably the winning answer to that question.
Managed to name drop.
Yeah, that's true. That's amazing. The next question is: what is your favorite sound or noise?
Music.
Enough said. And it makes total sense. What's your least favorite sound or noise?
Crying, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't like crying.
Is that the association of it automatically triggering?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just sad. Thinking quickly. There's loads of sounds I don't like. I don't like pneumatic drills. I don't like. Yeah.
You don't? Really? You're in a minority.
I'm just thinking of the first things that come into my head. Crying came into my head. I don't like hearing crying. I find that really upsetting to hear people cry.
What job or profession, other than your own, or let's say the ones you've attempted, would you most want
attempted,
to?
Charming.
Well, sorry, done. Done. I said that because you're committed to the one you're doing. Digging myself out of a hole very quickly. Would you most like to attempt?
I would love to. There's two and they're completely different. I'd love to be a superstar DJ, obviously. And I often am after like a few glasses of wine. My friends and family will agree with that. It's always very dramatic.
Is that DJs and like changing the tracks digitally or actually like old school?
Well, tech? A bit of both. Not so much old school now, but you know, I have.
But you could.
I've turned my hand back in the day. But now it would just be, mostly drunk and telling the room to be quiet and playing my favourite songs lots. A lot of that. But also, I would really love to work in a primary school because I'm so jealous of my friends and family who are teachers. So, because they just have the best stories and I really love kids and, mine all grown up. So, that's another one. That's completely different.
You could do both. Could you merge the two? Could you bring in like?
I have. I used to do the school discos for my kids.
There you go. Yeah. Teaching through music. Art should be more involved in schools anyway. Art and proper financial education. Two very lacking things in global education. What on the other side of the coin as a job or profession would you definitely never want to attempt under any circumstance?
I knew what this was straight away, and I feel really guilty saying it because it sounds so horrible. I would never want to work in a bank or for a big corporation. I'd pretty much rather do anything except for that.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean,
sorry to any actors that have side jobs in banks. I'm not judging you. Don't tell me.
Everyone's going to be like, I work. Everywhere's a corporation. We all work for corporate. No, but I know what you mean. It's the mechanism and the ethos behind some of it, you know.
It's weird. I was speaking to my stepdaughter and I said, God, I've made such sweeping judgments in my life about that. It's like, I always think that, I'd definitely get on better with a nurse or a teacher than I would someone who works at Amex. And it's like, that might not be the case.
To be fair, when I call and talk to the Amex reps, they're great. Like, they're really, really helpful. I think there's worse institutions. It's the system. It's the
It's just that thing of being led towards always thinking that it's this never ending ladder doesn't really appeal to me.
Oh well, that's true. I think that's any business. I've worked in big, huge digital marketing companies, and there's that idea of an imaginary brass ring. Yeah. And then eventually, how far do you go up getting a new job title until there are no more job titles? And then you look back and you go, that's 30 years of my life. For what?
And I haven't had a holiday and I've not seen my kids. So that doesn't appeal to me.
I hear you. Final question is, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? Or if we rephrase it, what kind of impact would you like to have made?
Well, this is really weird because in the last few years, just last week, another friend died a few years ago. One of my mentors died, and I'm still really close to his wife and all their kids. And I kind of remember at the time being so upset about it, but saying, "My God, what a bloody life Steve had!" You know, he was Elton John's producer, worked with Elton, was Billy Connolly's manager and Billy's best friend. He took immense photographs of him, you know, going around India and, you know, playing sitar in an ashram, you know, just all these amazing, you know, just living this life through the 70s. And he lived to, I think he was about 73 or 4 when he died. And I remember being so sad that he died, but thinking, do you know what, I'd take that amazing life. Like, he's had amazing kids, been doing a job that he loves all these years, you know, just really had, you know, always been really creative. You know, he was a big influence on me because he was always like, listen to it, you know, listen to what you're thinking, don't be steered by what everyone else is pretending they love, you know, all of these things that I kind of kept quite close to me. And then just literally a few days ago, another jazz promoter who I wasn't as close to as I was to Steve also died, but had a similar life. And he had spent his entire life supporting particularly black jazz musicians in the UK, giving them a platform, but also in America. He'd got the respect of people like Art Blakey and all these people that wouldn't normally be very interested in a white kind of, you know, middle class or student producer as he was then. And again, in his 70s, died a few days ago. And I kind of, again, I felt sad, but I also had a real kind of like, what a life. And it made me think of Steve again. And I thought, these are great lives. So I think that mine would be that I've got really amazing kids, a really happy marriage. I've got really lovely stepdaughters. And I really love my job. I mean, it sounds a bit cheesy, doesn't it, really? But I've had a really lovely time doing my job. I don't think everyone's as lucky to do jobs that they love. You know, we haven't, you know, I'm not really big on material stuff, so we got a decent enough house, but a shit car there, I saw. But I've travelled a lot with my kids and things like that. So yeah, is that the right answer? I don't know. That's more about what makes me happy if I died tomorrow.
There's no right or wrong answer. I think but I think inherently the essence of who you are comes through, and it's not about things, it's more about experiences, and it's more about living a life fully as opposed to living it within a box sort of cage and then looking back and going, what did I do?
I don't think I'll have that, which I think is a really nice thing. Definitely don't think I'll ever do that. And I'm still trying to, I suppose, in terms of what am I trying to, I'm still, you know, I am still trying to knock on some doors in terms of, you know, sometimes the industries that I've worked in can feel a bit close to certain people if you're not connected. If you know, some people are born into kind of acting families or born into casting families or born into music families. And, you know, I come from a background that didn't have any of that, and I've had a very lovely time getting into it. So I'm quite sort of vocal about that as well.
And, send the ladder back down as well and help people.
Yeah, and just also not just in a do gooder way, but also just in the fact that I think it just makes us a more interesting industry. I think there are more working class casting directors, more working class directors, writers, more BAME writers, directors, we're just going to be more interesting.
I mean, it comes up quite a bit. People do ask the questions around representation, whatever that means to people, and I think it's better, it's changing, it's evolving, it's still got ways to go. Ultimately, you know, my view is it's about person that's best for the job and best for whatever that thing is. But there needs to be more writers from these backgrounds telling their stories, artists telling their stories, having the platform to do it. Whether you are from, you know, a different racial background or gender or whatever, only they can tell those stories authentically because they've lived it. It's like, I've said this last week, I'm not growing up in, say, Brooklyn or the Bronx. I couldn't talk about that because it would be a caricature from afar. It would be what I've seen on TV. And I think we need more of that, more whatever that is to people.
And I think it's across the board. It's all in all the backstage jobs as well, because I think that those voices then can inform when something doesn't feel authentic. Whereas people who haven't lived in those areas or those kinds of lives don't know when something isn't authentic. And I think that's really important that we try and do that. So yeah, that would be that's the goal going forward.
Awesome. Awesome. Have you seen, I don't normally ask this question, it's kind of a two-pronged one at the end here. Number one, it's kind of like, what are you watching? Any kind of interesting things? But number two is, if you haven't seen it, have you heard of that new Netflix miniseries called The Eddie by Damien Chazelle?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's set in Paris, and it's about a jazz musician, which is why I thought of you as you were talking.
You email me, just to, I mean, it should stay in, but
I'll ping you a note. I've only seen the first episode. I think it's a 10 or 12 episode.
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. One-off. We'll love that.
And it's half in French, half in English, but it's all about like jazz. And it's got this gritty, it's weird. It's got this art house French style to it at times. But then at the other times, because it's Damien Chazelle, it does have that more cinematic feel. And then the music, I thought of you, the jazz.
I'd love to. Thank you. I will definitely, remind me and I'll check that out. What am I watching? We're watching loads. I mean, we're just consuming loads at the moment. I loved Normal People. I thought it was incredible. I loved Unorthodox. I just thought it was unbelievable. I didn't love Gangs of London. I saw how accomplished it was. I get that. It just didn't touch me in the same way that other things do. I thought Calm with Horses was amazing. I think think those performances by all three of them, but Cosmo Jarvis, just incredible. So, yeah, watching loads. And then revisiting the third series of the A Word at the moment, which is the little series that we liked before. So, yeah, all sorts of stuff. I've already forgotten something else, but yeah. And sometimes just The Chase, you know. We sometimes watch a quiz show. Yeah. It's like, whatever. And Grace and Perry's Art Club, you know, all sorts.
Keep it busy. But you're completing Netflix and Amazon and all the different.
Exactly.
Oh, well, now I feel guilty for throwing another one onto your watch list.
No, don't.
But it's I think you might like it because of just the musical background. Excellent. Well, listen, Nikki, it's been really awesome chatting to you. Last few moments for you, really. Any kind of final parting words of advice or messages for anybody that's watched or listened to this?
No, I mean, I just hope I didn't rattle too much. I probably did, just rattle on about nothing. There was probably not much structure. Just keep the faith, as we say. It will be all right. We will get out the other side. I do firmly believe that. And, yeah, just...